Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name's Christopher Webb, and with Rob, believe it or not, still on paternity leave, we're joined by another guest from the fantastic Betamax Video Club. It's Rich Nelson.
Hello. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm good. How's it going?
Thank you for the invite for this. I have enjoyed revisiting the film in question to see if it's still any good and to answer that eternal question.
Excellent. I'm very pleased to hear it. So you're jumping straight to it. So what have you chosen for us tonight?
Well, for this, I thought I'll stay slightly out of the 80s, but remember a film I remembered fondly, Kindergarten Cop, the classic.
He's a cop in a class by himself. He is fearless, unstoppable, unbeatable.
I forgot to introduce myself. My name is John Kimball, and I love my car.
Yo, man, I'm just gonna keep an eye on it for you, all right? You see what I'm saying?
Now, he's going undercover to face his toughest adversary.
Listen, Kimball, you gotta handle this like any other police situation.
They speak their own language.
You walk into it showing fear, you're dead.
They play by their own rules.
No fear.
No fear.
And they are totally ruthless.
No fear. No fear.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule.
Kindergarten Cop.
American history is practical man.
He's a cop. In a class. By himself.
Shut up!
I have a headache.
It might be a tumor.
It's not a tumor. It's not a tumor at all.
The new comedy from Ivan Reitman. Arnold Schwarzenegger. Kindergarten Cop.
They're horrible.
Kindergarten Cop from 1990. So why did you choose this, other than the fact that it's not in your normal decade?
It came out in 1990, so I'd have been 10. I was aware of Arnold Schwarzenegger at the time, having, unbeknownst to my mother, having already seen Predator at this age. And I'd seen, you know, some of the more slight, you know, Twins and the films that were slightly less bloody and gory. And when I saw this, when it first came out on video, the fact that it was set in a school and it had Schwarzenegger, it had a world that I was part of and it had experience of, and then Schwarzenegger, this kind of mythical beast who, you know, is this massive star who suddenly starts working in a school and there's this envy that maybe he could come and teach my class.
So it's your dream. Did you actually go and see it at the cinema, or was it a video or TV?
No, I think this would have been a video. We used to have a guy that come around in a van full of videos, which probably wouldn't be allowed these days. Is this big this big transit van, and he'd have these folders of all the covers for the videos, and then you choose from there. But I was already aware of the film, so of course when he got this one in, it was, yeah. Have you got Kindergarten Cop yet?
Excellent. Now, I did actually see this at the cinema. So it came out in 1991, so I was considerably older than your 10 years old at the time. I was a student, I was at Portsmouth Poly, and for some reason we all went to go and see an Arnie film set in a kindergarten, but I do remember enjoying it at the time. I'm not a particularly huge Arnie fan. I would have seen the usual ones at the time. I'd have seen Terminator and Predator and stuff like that. But that's probably about it. So it was fun to go and see. It was good.
It's weird, because having seen Twins and that, and you know, this was at a point where he'd already started to move from those big action films into comedy, and I guess, you know, around this time he was combining the two. I think Terminator 2 came out, I think, just after this. Yeah, it was just on a planet scale, he was probably the biggest box office draw at the time. And to get a film like this, you know, it's weird, because I know Sylvester Stallone was kind of his equal at some point, and he started moving into those films as well. And when you look back now and compare Kindergarten Cop to, say, some of Stallone's comedy efforts, like Stop or My Mum Will Shoot.
Or Oscar. Yeah, because I always thought, or I'd mistakenly thought, that this was his first foray into that comedy, but it wasn't. Twins came first, didn't it?
Yeah, I think Twins was a couple of years earlier, although I think with that, they did so well out of it money-wise. It had the same director as Ivan Reitman, who did that as well. And I guess when you suddenly realise that if you market films at a younger audience, you're opening the market up to many, many, many more dollars. You know, he probably looked like he needed a break as well. You know, it was other than the various children he had to interact with in this, it was probably slightly easier to do than some of the stunt-heavy films.
Yeah, probably slightly less exhausting. Although I did see that he insisted on having a gym built on the studio set, so he was still putting himself through it.
Yeah, I mean,
he just lifted children. It would be so much easier.
That's the thing, yeah. He's like, how many six-year-olds can you bench press? Yeah, I mean, that's an entirely different film. But when you look at it now and you think how much power and influence he had in that they filmed all the classroom scenes near his house so that he didn't have to commute too far and he could stay at home. It was, you know, built entirely around his schedule. And I think they did some Terminator 2 filming or promotional stuff or something while he was making this as well. So,
oh yeah, he went and did the teaser or something like that. Yeah,
and you think that, you know, that how everything kind of fits together like a jigsaw puzzle to allow that to happen. And I mean, the end result, it's, you know, we'll come on to it. It's slightly schmaltzy in a way, but I think, you know, when you look at films of that era, a lot of them were. And then when you see what came after this, you know, Jingle All the Way and Junior and movies like that, when you kind of think like his comedy career peaked early.
Yeah, I'd forgotten Jingle All the Way. Thank you for that.
Sorry. that can be the next episode.
It's called Still Any Good, not Was It Ever Any Good. But yeah, you know, Ivan Reitman, he got back again, I think, because he'd found Twins such an enjoyable experience. I think Arnie basically called the shots and said that he wanted Ivan Reitman on as director, which is a fair choice. You know, he's got quite good comedy stock in his back catalogue, you know, things like Stripes and stuff like that, and obviously moving on to things like Ghostbusters. So he knows what he's doing.
Anyone with Ghostbusters on their CV is going to have that much credit in the bank. And coming to do this, and you think, you know, Schwarzenegger, as we said, can do pretty much whatever he wants. They had a lot of influence, you know, in terms of the story as well. I mean, these aren't just kids who happen to be in a kindergarten. These are kids and families with various issues. There's a lot of single parents, broken homes, domestic abuse, all this kind of stuff that's covered in a comedy, which in 1990 or 1991, it's almost quite bold.
But also, I think, as well as the good comedy director, I noticed the two screenwriters, Herschel Weingrod and Timothy Harris, he'd worked with them on Twins. They also wrote Trading Places, Brewster's Millions. So again, they know what they're doing.
I suppose if you're coming into something and you want to make a good fist of it, and if you've got all the power behind you and probably significant money too, you're going to get people with a good track record. And I mean, those films, you're reading off a sort of a top list of films that I loved when I was growing up.
I mean,
maybe Trading Places, I probably saw that too young as well. But even Brewster's Millions as a remake, they made it contemporary and it was still very entertaining, and a lot of people's introduction to Richard Pryor in a, you know, a fairly inoffensive role that he was good in. And you know, when Schwarzenegger's the star in this, you get people behind the camera doing that sort of legwork, then it's not hard to get things wrong, in theory.
Yeah, I suppose it's kind of interesting. You probably don't get it so much anymore, that sort of star system where the main actor in it can just basically have whoever they want. There's probably very few actors that can do that these days. It doesn't really seem to work that way anymore.
When you look at the big names in those sort of films, people like Dwayne Johnson or someone like that, and it seems almost like he, or certainly gives off the impression that he almost turns up and will turn up for the paycheck. Beyond that, and I think the only influence he has on some of his films, from what I've read, is he insists that he has to win most or all of his fights in order to keep up his image.
You're joking.
No, I think there was Hobbs and Shaw, one of the Fast and Furious films. I haven't seen any of them, but there's a clause in his contract that he can't lose a fight.
He's built like a brick shithouse. He's not going to lose a fight.
Yeah, but I suppose if Jason Statham also has the same contract, then...
So I suppose we should probably talk about the film itself. It starts in a slightly different way because it does almost start like your bog standard 1980s Arnie action movie. You know, he turns up at a shopping mall. He's all scruffy and unshaven. He's a bit kind of Terminator-y. He's got his big trench coat on. He's pushing people out of the way. He's so bad and so scruffy. Surely he can't be a cop, can he?
So I've written here, he dressed like a hobo, sort of loitering around. And this is the issue with the film. And I know, you know, all the promotional material shows the film in a certain light. And then when it shows Schwarzenegger dressed like this, following a fellow with a ponytail around a shopping mall, and it's very dark and the music's quite overbearing. And then the credits for the film, the titles, are all in kind of childish comic crayon. Yeah. And you're sitting there going, have they got these mixed up or something? If you're watching it the first time round, that must be really weird seeing all these pinks and yellows and light blues covering that, telling you who edited the film.
I'd completely forgotten that's how it opened. All everyone remembers is the classroom and the funny things that the kids say. I'd completely forgotten that it was half an hour of kind of hard-edged brutality and guns going off and people being murdered.
You know, within the first, 10 minutes, you've got a drug-addled lady being handcuffed to her dead boyfriend and who's been shot in the chest by a sort of low-level gangster, and all this stuff about, you know, getting her to identify him in a lineup. And if you're expecting a light-hearted romp around, you know, a kindergarten, and all of a sudden you sit there thinking, you know, is this the right film, and where does a kindergarten come into it? And I know if you've got the premise of an idea, yes, you have to be creative in how you engineer how does Arnold Schwarzenegger end up in a kindergarten, but this is very odd. I mean, just watching it now, there's more blood than you'd expect.
Oh, totally, yeah, because that's what made me think. I was trying to work out who the target audience is, because like you said, that the promotional material is very, very family friendly. You could bring your kids to see this. And then the first half an hour, it's like a 15 certificate. There's swearing, there's violence, there's death, there's murder. There's all this sort of stuff going on.
You know, it's like when you flash back to some of the early Arnie films, like, I don't know, Raw Deal or Red Heat, where he's a cop and, you know, doesn't play by the rules and I work alone and all this sort of stuff, you know, standard Schwarzenegger tropes. And you know where Raw Deal ends up, you know where Red Heat goes. But they weren't promoted with a group of six-year-olds hanging off him and cartoon writing. So, I mean, I'll give the writers credit for not sugarcoating things too much. I mean, a whole film of the kindergarten would be quite hard work, I'd imagine. And you almost need that. You need that sort of savoury first course just to get into the main of the film.
Yeah. That's the way of putting it, yeah. And speaking of savouries, the man he's... I do love a bad segue, so speaking of savouries, the man he's following is called Mr. Crisp.
Is his first name Walker?
Yeah, that's right, Walker S. Crisp. It does sound like sort of a happy shopper Pringles, doesn't it? You go and buy some Mr. Crisp.
Yeah, you know what flavour he is, depending on what shirt he's got on. But it's strange when you think, especially looking back now, I'm not really sure at the time how it would have been, when you think that there wasn't an A-list or even a, probably sounds harsh, but a B-list actor to work off. This was Schwarzenegger on his own. He was the absolute star.
Yeah.
In Twins, it was as useful that he had Danny DeVito there as well. But there was no one, I mean, I think the guy playing Crisp, but I remember him from one of the, was it Kingpin or Something About Mary or one of those films?
Oh, okay.
I think he was in, but I don't remember seeing him in much else. He just happens to be Rent-A-Villain and he's dropped in. And even his partner, you know, I've seen her in a few films, Pamela Reed, but this is very much Schwarzenegger's films and the kids are the co-stars, as we'll come
absolutely to yeah mm. yeah everyone else is kind of background, aren't they, really?
Yeah.
So the whole point of it is Mr. Crisp, and I'm going to keep calling him Mr. Crisp throughout the whole thing because it does amuse me. There's a little bit of exposition with a dodgy man and a woman who we later learn is Cindy, and they're talking about Crisp's wife taking off with a couple of million dollars and the kid. And Crisp is obviously keen to know where he is. And this guy has seen him, and he knows that he's in Astoria, Oregon. So Crisp then gives that telltale question, which is, have you told anyone else about this? Which is, of course, code for run, he's going to kill you. You should never say no. You should say, yep, told loads of people, and you don't know who they are, and then just run. But he doesn't. He says no. So, of course, Mr. Crisp shoots him dead.
Yeah, I think if this was now, he'd go, no, well, I've passed it on Facebook. And
absolutely, you
know,
yeah.
Everyone knows. And again, this guy, he's obviously a skilled negotiator because he says, what's this information worth? $1,000? Oh, no, I'll go down to $750. You know, this is it's Life of Brian style haggling, you know, arguing about stuff. And then without agreeing anything or any money changing hands, he gives him all the information. So essentially, he's given it away for free. And then he ends up dead. So,
yep. But of course, Cindy's been hiding and she's seen and heard all of it. So she is now a witness. So Kimball, he handcuffs her to her freshly killed boyfriend. But then she gets away. I can't remember how she gets away. Does she just sort of walk or?
Maybe she cuts his arm off or something and runs off with the arm. But
she bites it off. Yeah.
Is that Saw 6 or something? But Mr. Crisp goes off for that very villainous chore of getting a manicure. And that's when he gets arrested by Schwarzenegger. But this kind of leads on to the whole process thing I won't go on too much about, where Cindy becomes the prime sort of witness, the only evidence it seems to hold Crisp to this murder, because luckily he chucked the gun in a skip and have a crisp there. He's got this thing where the case is built around her picking Crisp out of a lineup. That's all they've got. What other evidence does he have? Is there any forensic evidence? Is there any other witness? Have you got any ballistic evidence? Is there anything other than someone who's probably not very reliable sitting in a lineup going, that's the creep number five?
Well, that's why he had the manicure. He was washing away all of that gunpowder off his fingers, you see, just pretending to be a manicure.
You know, it all pins on that. And if, you know, if anything bad were to happen to her, or if she were to decide that she'd no longer cooperate in the case, what happens then? Mm. You've got someone suspected of murder just walks free.
But yeah, she does initially, as you say, decide not to cooperate. She walks, and so Kimball has to go downtown. He gate crashes this sort of weird underground party, which just seems to be full of sweaty, middle-aged, unshaven men wearing bandanas.
You imagine the casting call for that must have been odd.
Yeah, I could do that. I'll be in. But he does his usual thing. He roughs up some various innocent bystanders and shoots his gun at some furniture. I think this is where he says, because we're going to do a few impersonations along the way, I'm sure, this is where he says, I'm the party pooper, which is the first memorable line.
It is. This is almost a kind of trying to tie it back to his Terminator thing. You know, this is the sort of thing the Terminator would do, is go into a, well, in fact, the Terminator did do it, goes into a nightclub.
And he does do it, yeah.
Shoots it up, you know, looking for a youngish woman. And this, you know, he sits down next to her and sidles up and gets very creepy and saying he's going to sort of hassle her until the end of time.
Until she agrees to be a witness.
She gives that identification in the ID parade, and it was almost like the ID procedure in Bottom, where they're all sort of earning 20 quid to play the lineup, but she picks him out.
Even though he's trying to fool her with his cunning disguise, where he's got his hair down and he's a little bit unshaven, he's like one of Charles and Eddie, but she still spots him.
Yeah, she sees through it. I mean, despite the fact, I think she only saw him do the murder through some weirdly placed mannequins.
Yes, but even so, that's it. He's going down for this. So Kimball quite foolishly says, well, now we're going to go after your wife and son. He says, I know where they are. You shouldn't really do it. It's going to wind him up.
He's only been a cop for 12 years, as he reminds us. He works alone. Perhaps he's inexperienced enough to reveal that to the suspect.
He needs to learn a little bit more, which is lucky, because then he's teamed up with a new partner, which is Phoebe. And she's going along because they know that Crisp's son is at a kindergarten, or he's at a school, or a kindergarten in Astoria. And she used to be a kindergarten teacher, which is a piece of luck.
Yeah, if she's handpicked for that role, you know, do they have on record previous jobs that may come in handy for undercover work?
They might do. That's very good. So they're on their way. They fly to Oregon. And Kimball, he kind of gives the impression that he doesn't like children, because he basically threatens to kill some children on the plane who aren't really doing anything. They're just having a bit of a tussle.
Well, that's what you get for flying Ryanair.
Which is true, because the food's atrocious, because then Phoebe's not feeling well.
Yeah.
Phoebe's starting to throw up. So then there's a very long drive from wherever the airport is in Oregon to Astoria. It's not going well. Phoebe's sort of tired. She's sort of sleeping in the back of the car. And there's quite a poignant scene there where Kimball says that he hasn't seen his own son in years. So this is that first indication that what he really wants is his family. He says he'll go it alone, but really he'd rather settle down and be a family man. That's your first kind of hint.
Yeah.
And then Phoebe's assaulted by a small weasley mammal.
He obviously got out of Richard Gere's bag.
Oh dear, she'd have smelt that.
They've not known each other too long, and already his cool exterior is wasting away, where, yes, I have a son, I haven't seen him. And then the ferret comes out the bag and goes after him. He's overly affectionate to her. And all of a sudden he's like, oh, that's my ferret. Yeah, yeah, what do you...
Yes. Like
someone, I went to a wedding once and someone mistakenly asked me, oh, so do you have any photos of your dog? Which to me is like, oh my God, I've got to show you all of them. And immediately you start engaging John Kimball about a ferret, and he becomes the softest man in the world. Oh my God, let me show you.
But it's a ferret. He took that on the plane.
I know, but this was pre-9/11, so...
Oh. It's starting to get a bit worrying, because Phoebe's not very well, but she's supposed to be teaching tomorrow. I'm just wondering, what are they going to do?
If only they had a plan B, the sort of thing you'd sort of plan for in advance.
Maybe send two kindergarten teachers.
Yeah, they must have more than one on the books, yeah, on this magic register they have.
Oh, but as luck would have it, Kimball does have a plan, because the next morning, he's had a shave. He's wearing a nice sort of jacket and jeans combination, a bit Jeremy Clarkson. And so he decides that he's going to be the new kindergarten teacher. And this is where his whole character just changes instantly. As soon as he shaves his beard off, he's become this kind of nice, soft, weak, bumbling man. It's almost like Samson's hair. As soon as he shaves his beard off, there's no more Mr. Tough Guy.
You know, he's wearing the puffy shirt from Seinfeld, so he's already coming down to that level where how do you make yourself appealing? And surely he's changed his whole persona. One of the things he says is the first thing you learn about undercover work is don't do things you wouldn't normally do. But he's changed his image, his whole outgoing persona. He's got rid of what makes him Detective John Kimble and turned himself into basically a walnuts in a condom, but in a green blazer.
So then we're into Astoria, and we see a few images from other movies from the 80s in there. We see that bridge from Short Circuit.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we also see Mikey and Brant's house from The Goonies. I think there's a quick shot of that there as well, because that's just round the corner.
But again, like even the school, that looked like the exterior from the school from Back to the Future. Do all American schools look the same?
They seem to, don't they? They've got the big pillars. They try and do that kind of faux old, which, you know, probably built about 20 years ago, but they try and make it look like a stately home.
Except this one, the principal of this school is Princess Anne.
She's Edna from The Incredibles.
Yeah.
She's an Oscar winner, isn't she? That's Linda Hunt. She won an Oscar for playing a man.
Which film was that? I haven't done very good research.
Yeah, I've done my homework. It's The Year of Living Dangerously.
Ah, okay. I mean, in this, she's not in it a huge amount. I mean, she's very, very much, again, supporting cast. But she's really good. And you can imagine this short, middle-aged woman being quite fearsome when she has to be. And she certainly, you know, like almost everyone else in the school, warms to Kimble in time.
Eventually she does. So Kimble is waiting to see her. He sort of exchanges flirty eyes with Joyce, the pretty blonde teacher, Penelope Ann Miller. She's sort of telling some kid off for saying that he's wrong for hitting someone who killed his hamsters.
This is an awful school.
It's terrible, isn't it?
I'm trying to think what Ofsted would make of this.
They're sort of raising terrorists,
aren't they? I mean, you've got poison hamsters, boys punching girls, and that's just the start of it. That's before we meet some of the really odd kids in the kindergarten who, I don't know what sort of safeguarding measures this school have got in place to protect the minds of young kids, but we'll learn about some of them. I mean, some of them have been exposed to some really adult things in time, and it's, you know, these kids are supposed to be six.
Yeah. And some of his teaching methods don't really help. They are a little bit paramilitary. So it's probably not helping.
No, I mean, you know, we talked about this. The first time I've watched this film since I've had kids.
Yeah.
My kids are 4 and 2. I have them one day a week instead of nursery, and they run rings around me, and they're bumping into stuff, they're falling over, hitting each other, all this. You know, his first reaction when he meets the class is screaming, "Shut up! Shut up!"
Like Austrian Windsor Davis. Yeah.
Runs out the main door screaming, and you kind of think like, that's exactly how I feel, except I go into the bathroom and do it. I don't run outside just in case the neighbours hear.
I agree, actually. I mean, mine are a little bit older, but I've always done that. Just screamed and legged it and just left them to it. And they tend to calm themselves down when you're not in the room.
I mean, I've not gone as far as going out to my car to bring in a rogue ferret or anything. I mean, we've got a Labrador who kind of just has the eternal look of, why did you have these children? Life was so much better when they weren't here.
Yeah, our dog does the grommet look constantly as well when they're on her back and pulling her ears and just screaming, absolutely. So when Kimball is, before he gets to the classroom, he's talking to, is it Miss Schlofsky, is the headmistress?
Yes, I think.
Yeah,
so.
She kind of says to him, I don't really see the need to replace a kindergarten teacher with an undercover cop. And I was sort of asking myself the same thing, because it's not a very good plan. We'll just put a police officer in a kindergarten.
And especially when they kind of said, I was told by the school superintendent that I had to replace them. You kind of wonder, immediately when they're expecting one person and then someone else turns up in their place. You know, if you're presented with a kindergarten teacher, I mean, this is a story where Arnold Schwarzenegger doesn't exist. I guess this is the whole premise of The Last Action Hero. You know,
yeah.
You know, we're in an alternate timeline where these films don't happen. Suddenly this guy turns up and all of a sudden he's like, I want to be the sole carer for all these six-year-olds you have.
You're right. It should raise a little bit more suspicion. You told us that a young woman's going to come and teach the children. She's an undercover police officer, so presumably you're after somebody who's really bad. And then a complete stranger who's built like a brick shithouse turns up and says, I'm doing it instead. that would have just raised a lot of suspicion.
It was the 90s. It was fine.
Yeah, so he goes in to see the kids, and he's big and they're small. Just imagine that. Then he gets the usual funny kid stuff. So there's a boy who's sort of obsessed with death because his dad's an undertaker. So he's talking about, oh, did she die? Did he die? Did somebody die? And then we get the vagina boy, who everyone's a big fan of.
The vagina boy. What a nickname.
Yeah.
This is where you're slightly concerned if you hope they grow out of all this. But, you know, if you're met with that on day one, if a six-year-old boy is coming in talking about penises and vaginas and death and all that stuff.
It is true, though. They don't really grow out of thinking that words like penis and vagina are hilarious. Because my kids still do it. At the dinner table, we can't eat a meal without them talking about diarrhea or vaginas or something. It just never ends. And how could I not laugh? And, of course, laughing encourages them, which is fine. First of all, I thought, oh, imagine getting a little boy like that, who's probably about 5 years old, to say things like penis and vagina. But then I looked him up on IMDb. And his previous film was Pet Sematary. He was the little boy in Pet Sematary.
Oh, wow.
So this is probably a step closer to decency for him. Then Arnie Kimball starts interrogating the children about their parents. So he's not trying to be a kindergarten teacher at all. The first thing he does is basically ask them loads of questions about their parents, which is, of course, then interrupted by little Emma, who I think she's been hired for her cuteness rather than her acting skills. And she needs the toilet. She's the little girl from Beethoven.
Yes, yes.
And so Arnie does the typical thing of, because it's a toilet, it's woman's work. So he gets a woman to take her to the toilet.
It was the 90s.
It was the 90s. And by the time he gets back, it's bedlam. And this is where he does that big shut up. And all the kids blub. And he, of course, he introduces the ferret to the classroom.
Yeah, I mean, he has my complete sympathies for that. My oldest, she will leave toileting to the exact last second. You know, she won't go when she's told.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Luckily, we don't put her in dungarees or anything. If it was up to her, her school uniform would be a tutu. But, bear in mind, he's in a classroom with all these people's kids. They're other people's kids. And someone said to me once, kids are like farts. You only ever like your own. Yeah, I'm not surprised he had a virtual meltdown.
Yeah, I'm with him on that. Yeah, so with his first day over, it's horrible. He hated it. And that's when Phoebe sort of says to him, well, you're going to have to carry on. I can't go back in tomorrow or your cover will be blown. And I thought, will it? It was clear that he was terrible on his first day. Couldn't they just sack him and get a replacement in?
Did they just tolerate him purely because we've been told to put an undercover police officer into the school? His mission is clearly more important than the education and welfare of these young people.
Of course it is. Of course it is. But he stays, he goes back. And then there's the scene where some of the parents are talking and they're saying, well, he must be gay. If he's a kindergarten teacher and a man, he must be gay. And then they turn around and see him. And of course, he's a very well-toned, well-dressed man in a tight top and very tight trousers. So, nope, doesn't look gay at all.
It's funny, like, this is clearly in as an ego boost for Schwarzenegger because I guess I don't find him attractive. But then, you know, a lot of people probably do and he needs to have that thing in there where if people see me on a big screen in a Hollywood film, they have to make it appear that I am attractive. You know, walking yeah. around with his muscles, the sleeves on his shirt are a little bit too short and showing this off. You know, we don't have a very varied palette of people here. He's clearly gay. If he's a kindergarten teacher, you know, he's yeah. unmarried. What's wrong with him?
Absolutely. Yeah. It may have been one of his conditions. Like we said before, he had some conditions to make the film. So he wanted various aspects of domestic violence in it. He wanted an exercise regime to be part of the film. And maybe the last one was he wanted everyone to fancy him.
Yeah.
But this is where Arnie starts meeting some of the parents and he starts trying to work out who Mrs. Crisp, Mr. Crisp's wife is. And Sylvester's mum, which is Kathy Moriarty, comes in and starts talking to him. And, you know, she's a bit sassy. She dresses differently from everybody else. She's like a gangster's wife. Father doesn't live with them anymore and she's not from round here. So she must be Mrs. Crisp, surely. Must be.
Clearly, I mean, she's a golden wonder with her hair. But, I mean, the fact that she was in, she'd been in Raging Bull.
Yeah.
In a Scorsese film. So clearly she has some sort of gangster links. And
absolutely.
I mean, the fact that they kind of lay that on at first until all of a sudden she kind of went, well, no, he left us for another man. But then you kind of think, yes. well, she said it. There's no reason to think, like, that's just a cover. That's what we tell people.
Well, exactly, yeah. You may as well say he's gone to live in France. You know, it's yeah. a cover. But then they have this conversation, which I found a little disturbing. Again, it was the 90s, but she's really worried about Sylvester because he's playing with dolls. And he sort of reassures her. He doesn't say, well, there's nothing wrong with that. let kids be kids and play with what they want. He says it's all right because he's looking up girls' skirts. And she sort of goes, oh, thank God for that. He's just a pervert. Okay, brilliant.
If you go to a parents' evening and your kindergarten teacher says, well, he's a borderline sex pest and he'll probably start abusing animals soon. And she goes, oh, thank God.
Oh, I thought he was playing with dolls. Oh, what a relief.
I wanted him to be in the next Scarface, but yeah.
And then, of course, we get another one of those famous, often memed lines where Kimball says he has a headache and little death-obsessed boy says it's probably a tumour. So, of course, Kimball says, and I'll leave it to you.
It's not a tumour.
It's not.
It's a memeable line. If you ever mention this film on Twitter or Facebook, everyone comes back with that. But I mean, I struggle again. Is that normal? And I know this kid isn't normal because we know he's obsessed with death, but he knows about tumours and he's almost diagnosing him. He's like Dr. Google. He's like a sort of anxious mother with WebMD or something like that. It's quite off-putting.
And of course, Kimball doesn't like it because it's not a tumour. but then he starts up with his interrogation again and he plays a wonderful new game called Who's Your Daddy? It's like scum for CBeebies, isn't it? And then we get the talking heads, some of which are funny. There are kids talking about some of the funny things their dad does. The little boy talks about vaginas again. Some of them are really dark. There's a little kid who says, my dad doesn't do anything since the accident. He's like, oh my God. And this is sandwiched between some real light-hearted antics.
You know, and again, they're talking about my dad's a deadbeat, or my mum says my dad's a deadbeat, or my dad just lies and watches TV all day. And it's kind of thinking, this is almost like benefit shaming that you get where people say, oh, he doesn't do anything. And I'd love a spin-off to find out what, inverted commas, the accident is.
My word. That is dark.
And you've got those two twins who say that their mum says their dad's a real sex machine. And I mean, he must be, if this woman is bragging to her 6-year-old daughters.
Maybe it's James Brown. But then a nice little boy called Dominic gets up. And we've seen him before because on the end of Kimball's first day, he basically goes up to Kimball and says, you're shit. Everyone's better than you.
quit now.
And he sort of hints at his mum's a teacher. Yeah, quit now. But he gets up and says, oh, I haven't seen my dad in a long time. You think, well, it could be him. And he says, oh, but my dad lives in France. Do you think, well, it's definitely not him then. But then he notices there's another little boy, Zach, at the back. And he's not taking part because he's, and I quote, a ca-ca poo-poo face. So all the kids pick on him. He's very, very distant. So maybe it's him. But before Arnie can ask him any questions, that's when you get the fire alarm balls up. There's a fire drill, everyone panics, and they're basically told that they would have all burned to death if that had been a real fire.
They're being shamed in front of their peers. And I mean, these are 6-year-olds. I know it's Kimball's second day on the job, trying to corral these kids out. I mean, it's hard enough to get mine out of the house in the morning, but the little Princess Anne head teacher is still saying, you should be ashamed of yourselves.
Well, they're going to take that home with them. My head teacher said I should be ashamed of myself today. Why was it? Were you looking up a girl's skirt? Nah, just a bit late for the fire drill.
I was going to burn alive, but you know.
So to sort of drown his sorrows after another bad day, Kimball and Phoebe, they go out to a restaurant. It's sort of like the Astoria Harvester. It's a very sort of family-friendly restaurant.
It's a salad bar.
And Dominic and his mum are there. And would you believe it? His mum is the saucy blonde one who's been smiling at him, who we learn is called Joyce, another teacher at the school. So not to blow their cover, because, of course, you should never do what you would normally do or whatever that thing is that they said earlier. So Phoebe pretends to be Helga from Hello, Hello. She does her best kind of nondescript European accent and pretends to be his sister so as not to raise any suspicion.
She orders lots of European-style food, but dropping in the odd bit of German as well. Like, I will have that mit something else.
Yeah, that's right.
To be fair, I mean, that was one of, you know, my GCSE German report. It was, he tends to use a lot of English words in a German accent when he doesn't know. And again, it's that sort of phrase where I'm just going to do a really bad Arnold Schwarzenegger impression and pass off as his sister.
Yeah, they seemed very exotic, didn't they? And they take to her very much because she is very entertaining. And while she's stuffing her face, that's when Kimball tells Joyce sort of a load of bull about his Austrian traditions and the fact that he used to teach geography and basketball in an all-girls school and all these strange things that he says to her, which again would have set alarm bells ringing. But it goes well, and Phoebe basically tells Kimball that he should go and fill his boots. He said, the Love Doctor's in town, so just go for it, my son. Just the sort of thing an undercover cop should be doing.
Depends how deep undercover you're going to go. I mean...
Indeed.
I guess she's the closest to a celebrity there is in the film, and I guess immediately you kind of think that having her involved in some of her previous roles, but, you know, he was probably involved in her casting as well, Schwarzenegger. You just think, if I was going to find a single mother to befriend, and he just looks for a catalogue of young, attractive women, then that one will do.
That one, yeah. So this is when Kimball kind of opens up to Phoebe and says that the kids are pushing him around. He's having a terrible time. So she basically says, you know, show no fear and treat it just like any other undercover situation. Just treat it like he would as a policeman. Bearing in mind, all he does as a police officer is sort of punch people and shoot things with his big gun. It's probably not the best advice in a kindergarten, but he does it anyway.
Not only does he have a ferret in his luggage, he also has his police whistle, or he's bought one while he's there. And again, sort of turns up thinking, what's the best way to communicate with six-year-olds is treat them like recruits at the police academy and various goons you meet out in the street and making them do exercises and stuff. And I guess maybe this is the closest we get to police academy sequel is, you know, you've got the kid who talks about penises and vaginas and he can be Mahoney, and you've got another one who could be Zed or Hightower or the girl like Hooks.
Wow.
And all this.
So this is like a prequel.
Maybe, yeah, this is where he started.
Police Academy, the early years. Wow, you're onto something.
John Kimball is Captain Harris or the Commandant, but...
Yeah. As you said, his way of teaching the children is... He calls it police school, but it is just sort of shouting and intimidation and aggression. And the kids seem to like it. They're okay with it. His first sort of success is he blows a whistle and they go and get a toy. Then he blows a second whistle and they go and put the toy back. If that's what my kids were doing at kindy, I'd have cancelled my donation years ago. That's not what I expect them to be doing at kindergarten.
It's like the old sort of Barbara Woodhouse dog training school, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. But then he tops up by screaming in Emma's face because she doesn't want to sit down.
This is kind of where I again found some sympathy. He said, you're a police officer. And she said, I'm not a policeman, I'm a princess. This is the argument I have with my kid every day, is that she wants every, you know, without any effort from myself, she seems to be completely now into princesses and unicorns. And it's like, oh, do you want to wear so-and-so today? No, I want the unicorn this. Oh, it's dirty. Well, wash it then.
Yeah, that's right. So it's home clothes day in school. So I've laid you out a lovely sweatshirt and some leggings. Oh no, I want the Elsa dress, please. The Rapunzel dress with the clip-on hair.
That is my life.
Because then he gets them marching and chanting as well, which is nice.
Yeah, just like an Avar-Austrian.
She's not overly concerned that he seems to be sort of raising a toddler militia. Then we get a nice touching moment where he badly reads an A.A. Milne poem to them. Where he sort of says, that's where I want to go today.
That's where they start sort of grilling him about his son as well. You know, they're very knowledgeable about divorce, these kids, because probably half of their parents are divorced.
Yes, that's right. So he opens up a little bit more to them and says he hasn't seen his son in a long time and it wasn't his fault at all. But it seems to work. They all fall asleep. And when they're sleeping, he has a dream about Mr. Crisp.
Because it had been a while, I think, since we'd seen Crisp. You know, he appears at the window of the school and Schwarzenegger's having a little nap with all the rest of the kids. And it's very nice. I suppose it's like, you know, hello, nice colleague. I'm a single mum. Come and entertain me this evening. And my child will be your butler. It's one of those things, it's a sign. If you turn up and you see the kid, immediately you see the kid, you think, oh here we go, not getting any tonight.
Oh, yeah. That's that then, yeah.
Fully blocked.
Yeah. But before he gets there, this is where he talks to Zach. Zach was the quiet one, the kakapoo head. He's the very quiet one, and he's talking to Zach's mum and basically deciphers or learns very, very quickly that Zach is being beaten and she might be as well. And he just kind of lets her off with a warning.
It's like the next time I'll press charges. It seems a bit like, oh, well, if it happens again, you know, if the dog ate it or whatever.
I'll do it for you this time, but next time, yeah.
Being a police officer, you'd think his experience apparently of being a police officer is threatening people with oversized shotguns and walking around in a trench coat. It's not being very touchy-feely and providing decent victim support and safeguarding.
So, yeah, this is when we're suddenly thrown back to the city, the brutality of the city, and it does get brutal again very, very quickly because we see Sydney the witness and she's given a bad dose of whatever it is. And she's dead, just dies of an overdose.
Yeah, because when Chris was put on remand in jail, he was, poor policing, allowed to speak to his mum and go, you take care of this, sort it out. His mum is the real brains behind the operation when she gives the dealer the bad gear just to get rid of this witness. And the next thing we see is Cindy lying dead on a slab in the mortuary. And it's like, oh, well, there goes our case. It's like, really? But this is a Hollywood film. This is where we need some peril to come in, you know, because Kimball's getting deep, deep, deep. We need something to keep him on his toes.
Yeah, because he's starting to relax. He's starting to enjoy himself, which of course he does, because he's having a dinner date with Joyce. And while she's preparing the dinner, Dominic shows him around and he takes him outside and shows him his lasers in case the bad people turn up again. And then he shows him this kind of big telecommunications tower where he says he's going to plant a device. So it's like Dominic's like a 5G truther, isn't he?
I actually wrote down, I think Dominic's related to David Icke. But this is...
I put John Cusack and Amanda Holden.
This is the strange thing. I mean, he is... Did he have a tinfoil hat at one point as well? I can't remember. But this is where, you know, this is conspiracy theory 101, where, you know, all this stuff's going on. All these alarm bells would be ringing if it wasn't for the 5G tower about to be burnt down. and it, because of the bad people. We find out later on why he thinks of bad people, and it actually becomes quite logical. But especially watching it at this time when antennas are the evil thing and people on YouTube are making videos about bad people and lasers, and they all wear tinfoil hats and shell suits or whatever David Icke does.
Because when he said lasers, I thought he said lizards, first of all, and that's when the alarm bells started ringing.
Well, if you're the reserve goalkeeper for Coventry, I don't know. These things...
Tony Gubbin ever put up with this sort of shit. And that's when Kimball remembers he's a police officer and he thinks that Joyce may be Mrs. Crisp. So he pretends to go to the toilet and Dominic catches him going through Joyce's underwear drawer. So he has to sort of make his excuses very quickly.
That's good. Just as well he didn't walk in and he had one on his face like a mask or something. You know, he's doing all this stuff. And I mean, like, there's polite company. There's also, does he have a warrant for any of this? I don't know. And yet, was it Sebastian, I think, was the kid whose dad was gay or ran off with the other man. And he, you know, accepted that at face value. So, I mean, had he been invited around there, would he go through Kathy Moriarty's drawers? I don't know. But God knows what he'd have found in there.
Probably a little boy in there looking at them. Again, this is where he starts talking to Joyce. And of course, because he's still unsure of who Mrs. Crisp is, this is where she says that her ex doesn't live in France. He was a bit of a wrong'un, and she just told Dominic that. So now he's pretty sure that she's the one.
He has an ASBO and she had to run away from him. There's the whole story around that she stole money from him, which is why they're after him. You know, they're looking for all this money and it turns out it's just a ruse by Crisp to get people looking for this woman in the hope they'll get a reward of some sort. But she's, you know, living in this nice house and everything, and so immediately one of these like snoopers, she's a single mum living in a nice house, you know, it's almost like Call the Daily Mail.
She's got a widescreen television and things like that, which of course people it's disgraceful. But then we see the next day they're preparing for the school fete. So Kimball's got the Gettysburg Address, so his class are doing the 4 score and 7 years ago. And what did make me laugh was when he tells the kids to take a break, it's not take a break and play with some toys. He just says, I'll just go and walk around in a big circle until I get back. It's just appalling.
I mean, having seen the opening of Conan the Barbarian, where he does that, you know, that's his slavery, as he's trudging around this circle, pushing this enormous thing. Just imagine what he's doing to these kids, and they're all going to turn out to be Austrian bodybuilders. It's fantastic.
And then, for whatever reason, Sylvester's mum pops in again, and she's donated a Shetland pony to the school raffle.
If this was another film, in the next scene, we'd see the pony's head in the toddler cot or something like that.
Like the kid who's obsessed with death or the vagina boy had won that raffle. It was just, I really feel for that little pony.
It's a prequel for Dexter. Yeah.
Just vouchers for the garden centre would have been fine. Or a cake. But of course, this is when Kimball then sees Zach's new bruises. So he does what I suppose we would all think was justifiable, but as a police officer and a teacher, probably shouldn't have done it, which is he beats up Zach's dad in front of the kids. Problem solved.
Yeah, and the weird thing is he's already got a good punch in, and then it's only when he comes to the second one and he gets a touch of the seconds and goes, ooh, maybe I shouldn't. It's a bit late now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's only so much you can cover the first one with either self-defence or a preemptive strike or anything like that. This is all, I've hit him, he's offering no threat to me whatsoever, I've just assaulted him.
Yeah.
Yes, the intentions were noble, but yeah, no leg to stand on here.
Yeah. So one would think, especially as the head teacher, she's quite strict. She runs a tight ship. She thinks she'd kick him out or at the very least give him a big bollocking, but not really. She sort of just says to him, well, you lied about being a teacher. You've never taught anyone in your life. You introduced a small bitey mammal into the class that probably hasn't been vaccinated. We don't know. We haven't checked. You seem to be training up an army of flag-waving infants. And you punch parents in front of children, which I quite enjoyed, to be honest. You're a very good teacher. Wow.
You know when this woman, who I think is almost certainly medically a dwarf, says to him about what was it like to hit that son of a bitch?
Yes.
And it's just, you know, immediately this is almost like her sort of suddenly revealing that she is a good person as well, in that she's like, oh, she's on the side of justice. And maybe in the sequel, and we haven't talked about the sequel of this film.
No.
Maybe she turns up as an undercover teacher playing a cop.
Ooh.
You know, that would be an almighty role reversal.
That is a great idea. But yeah, because if you just committed an act of violence as a position of authority and someone said to you, how'd that make you feel? Did it make you feel good? It's a trap. You're not meant to go, it felt great. You're meant to go, oh, sorry, I know I shouldn't have done it. But no, he just goes, yeah, it felt brilliant, actually. And she just goes, hooray, me too.
She actually got a little bit horny from it. Yeah,
yeah, she loved it. So we go to the actual school fete. We've seen the rehearsal, so we're at the school fete, and it's all going on. There's fairground rides, there's like a petting zoo, there's three-legged races, there's like a diddly band playing in the background. It's brilliant. Better than our old school fates used to be, where we just did bingo.
I'm trying to think who finances this. You know, they've got all this stuff going on, all these rides, they've got a stage, and this is the sort of thing I notice where these six-year-olds are giving the Gettysburg Address to a load of parents there. I didn't see any microphones or amplifiers or speakers or anything. I mean, they must have really projected their voices. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe this is something that Kimball taught them off camera.
Yeah, probably. It's about projection, yeah. But the funding, it's a very good point, because there was no sort of selling of raffle tickets. There was no fundraiser. It's probably just Sylvester's mom.
That's where the $3 million went.
Yeah. There is no money.
Yeah.
The diddly band took it all. So they do the Gettysburg Address, and then Kimball gets a standing ovation for being the best teacher in the world, and the kids all love him.
I'm sure the other teachers were loving that as well.
Yeah, this guy who's just turned up. But of course, the head teacher knows he's not really a teacher, but yet she's sort of saying to everyone that he's the best there is. You don't need training, you just need to turn up.
I mean, if this mission that she doesn't know about goes to plan, surely within days, weeks, he's going to be gone again. And all of a sudden,
exactly.
You know, not only are we explaining the mystery disappearance of the previous kindergarten teacher, we're now explaining the mystery disappearance of the new kindergarten teacher. And then things are going to start being like, what's going on?
And this is when Mr. Crisp, he's in town, and he basically assaults an old man for his Scalextric.
Yeah, this is a weird kind of robbery thing going on. I don't know. To say that out of any context, it's he robs an old man of his Scalextric. It's fascinating to see. I mean, maybe it was some kind of currency in prison where he'd spent the last few days and weeks. You know, people don't trade cigarettes anymore. He's like, I mean, it turns out he wanted...
He's never going to stick that up his arse.
keep that inside a Kinder Egg. But this is where he's trying to be the doting dad that he never... I think... Was the kid maybe 6 months, 9 months or something when they ran away from him?
Mm.
And then the grandmother, who, because everyone loves a mummy's boy and an overbearing parent, is in Boots buying all this stuff, like a rectal thermometer and everything. It's just like...
Oh, yeah, Jesus Christ, yeah.
Is she just one of those parents who'll believe anything they read on inspirational Instagram posts or something? It's like, oh, no, this is how you need to parent. You need to shove a thermometer up their arse 5 times a day.
Are we supposed to think that because she was so kind of overbearing and one of these sort of parents that it made him the man that he is. I don't know. Is that what it's supposed to insinuate?
You know, it's almost like if we'd have just boiled down the three Star Wars prequels to this, you know, it could have been Darth Vader's overbearing mother turned him into an intergalactic Sith Lord and not just some whiny little kid just because he had the thermometer up there.
But of course, because Mr. Crisp is in town, this is where Phoebe and Kimball, they have to tell Joyce the truth. They tell her that he knows where she is. And she, of course, then says, well, there is no money. It's Dominic that he wants. There was never any money. It all went on that very nice house and the explosives for the telecommunications tower. So she legs it. She runs. She tells Dominic that the bad people are back. And then they go to Joyce's house and Dominic's suddenly missing because he doesn't want to go. And Kimball knows where he is because he said something about his lasers. And he is climbing the telecommunications tower with his little backpack strapped to him. I thought, has he never seen a public information film? If he's not climbing that tower, he's going to be retrieving frisbees from substations.
Yeah, or he's going to be crossing level crossings without looking.
Picking up sparklers.
Yeah.
But he has a little fall and he's saved by his explosive backpack and Kimball comes to the rescue. And because of that, he sort of persuades Joyce to stay by giving her a big clumsy old snog.
Pete, I mean, this is like, again, deep undercover. What would you do to someone who's going to be a witness in your case against her ex-husband is you're going to kiss her and do all sorts of things to her.
Get off with them.
It seems a bit weird when you see Crisp in the office with the principal the next day, is that here, you know, we're at the end of the film. You know, this is where the showdown's going to be in the school because he just happens to be in there. And it's like, well, they've put no sort of protections in place to keep her or the kids safe. It's just kind of like, oh, we'll just carry on as normal. We don't want to spook anyone, do we? I mean, I don't know. Are they aware at this point that Crisp is out of prison?
This is the morning after they've said he's coming. He's free and he knows you're here. Yeah. So they just send him back to work.
Yeah. It's even worse.
They could have got a substitute teacher from the police force to come and stand in for it. It would have been very easy. Bloody loads of them.
Yeah.
But they are prepared because Phoebe delivers a stranger danger talk to the class.
Well timed.
And even though Dominic's already met Ursula, he doesn't kind of go, I know you. Why are you talking like that? Surely Dominic recognises her, but he doesn't. It's probably that tower. It's messing with his brain. And just for larks, in case we've forgotten, the little boy says vagina again and sort of does a little victory thing with his hands because he's managed to say vagina in a classroom again.
That's what I imagine when the little kid starts shaking his hands, going, hey, I said vagina in school. This is kind of what you imagine in the House of Commons, in where if they manage to get in a certain phrase and they're sitting at the end going, come on. Yeah.
And he's very pleased. And so is Phoebe. She liked it as well. She thought it was funny, as you would. And this is where Mr. Crispy's having his tour of the school. And he looks in the classroom and he sees Dominic. And even though he hasn't seen him since he was about 6 months old, he recognises him immediately. He knows it's him. But oh, Kimball's there as well. And that must have been a bit of a shocker.
Yeah. I suppose if you see your, in his eyes, the villain of the piece is suddenly like, oh, there's my child. And there's the cop who's trying to either kill me or put me in prison. Just happens to be the teacher. And just kind of go, ooh.
So he does the natural thing. He starts a fire in the library.
And you kind of think about what's his plan. He's going to burn the school down and hopefully get away with the kid. It's he's kind of gone straight to 11, hasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Amidst the mad, crazed panic of a burning school, he's going to identify the boy he hasn't seen for 5.5 years and abduct him. It's a great plan.
You can see why he's this criminal mastermind.
But the fire alarm goes off and Dominic takes the ferret that definitely doesn't bite. We've been told that twice already. It doesn't bite. And then something happens, which I've mentioned on this podcast before. And it is one of those little bugbears of mine. And it's sprinklers in films. They don't all go off at the same time. It doesn't happen in real life. But it works because Mr. Crisp stops Dominic and grabs him. But luckily, because they've just had Stranger Danger training, somebody shouts Stranger. And so Mr. Crisp has to run away. He runs and hides in an empty classroom. And he's trying to convince Dominic that he's his father. And the way he convinces him is because they've both got hands.
Have you ever seen that episode of Friends where Joey tries to convince the croupier at the casino that they've got, I think he calls him an identical hand twin. He says, our hands are exactly the same. And this is it. It's kind of like, well, I have hair, you have hair. Therefore, we are related. I mean, this is pre-Jeremy Kyle.
But even Dominic's addled and scrambled brain doesn't fall for it. He's not convinced that just because they've both got hands that they're related. And so he runs off, and I think Crisp takes him to like the sort of changing rooms for gym class or whatever. And this is where Kimball, he bursts in and he catches two kids snogging. And the boy is Academy Award nominated director Jason Reitman, director of Juno and Up in the Air.
I think it's nepotism that he got this role.
Yeah, it's take your kid to work day. So what can we do for my son today?
Yeah, kiss a teenager. You can pick which one. In about 25 years' time, when Me Too comes out, this girl can say, I was picked out of a lineup for the director's son's pleasure. It was his birthday that day.
And this is where Phoebe, she knows something's afoot, so she tries to get into the school, but old Mother Crisp runs her over, squashes her with her car. So she seems to be out of the picture as well. Dominic's still trying to get away from his dad, and he sort of waggles the ferret around just to remind us that he's got it.
Sounds like slang.
He's waggling the ferret, yes. I'm going to use that, that's great. And then it all kicks off in the changing rooms. Joyce turns up and Crisp hits her. Kimball turns up, and of course, because Dominic's hostage, he makes him lower his gun. He's about to kill Kimball, but luckily then the ferret that doesn't bite bites Crisp on the neck. And so Kimball's only shot in the leg.
That's a well-trained ferret.
He's very well-trained, yeah. He knows when his dad's in trouble. So he shoots Kimball in the leg because the bite on the neck has sort of distracted him a little bit. And so Kimball is able to shoot and kill Mr. Crisp. And that's the end of that. But of course, old Mother Crisp is there too. She shoots Kimball again. And so then she's about to kill him because he won't say where the boy is. But luckily, Phoebe's not dead. She hasn't been killed by the car. And she flattens old Mother Crisp with a baseball bat. And so both baddies have been stopped, terminated, if you like.
I was going to think of some sort of Crisp-related pun there, but, I mean, luckily Phoebe wasn't too frazzled after being hit by the car. But,
yeah, she's had her chips.
Just after the ferret had already munched on that monster. Sorry.
I can't think of any more. And that's it. So Kimball's in hospital with his bad leg. And then Phoebe turns up with her hilarious, clumsy fiancé, who I don't think we mentioned earlier. He's a chef and he's clumsy.
Yeah, because she likes to eat. He's a chef. It's a marriage made in a kitchen.
And the best thing he makes is pasta a olio, which is spaghetti and olive oil. What a chef.
Blimey. That sounds like student cuisine, or like even pot noodle couldn't come up with that.
Noodle a la pot, yeah. She's getting married and invites him to the wedding and, of course, does the little... So where do we send the invitation?
How open have we left this?
Yeah. So he decides to stay. He doesn't go back to the city to be a cop. He comes back to the school and he bursts in on the class, blows his whistle and says, I'm back. You see what they did there?
Oh,
very good. Yes. Very clever. And so she lets him back as a full-time kindergarten teacher.
But then who's the kindergarten teacher there when he bursts into the room? Because I think when Joyce or Rachel comes in and they kiss and everyone's happy, the new kindergarten teacher stands there clapping.
Yeah.
That might well be her first day on the job. All of a sudden, a large man with gunshot wounds has come in, kissed a gangster's ex-wife while all the kids cheer. Like, what am I going to do? Clap, clap, just do what comes natural.
Yeah, just clap, yep. Well, the head teacher's clapping, I'll just join in. Well, I think it's Mrs. Hagley, because at the beginning of the film, she does say Mrs. Hagley's had to be stood down for this.
So she's come back.
I imagine this is Mrs. Hagley thinking she's got her job back. But no, poor Mrs. Hagley, she's out again. She's got to go somewhere
else. And she didn't even get a line in the film. Stand there and clap.
He's back as a full-time job teaching children sort of 6 years old. You know, even though he's risked the lives of every pupil and teacher in the school, punched a parent, was only a substitute in the first place, and doesn't have a teaching qualification. But never mind, come back.
It was the 90s.
So I liked your idea of a sequel of the head teacher being an undercover teacher in the police. I think there should also be that sort of spin-off where Kimball has to go to sort of like Astoria Polytechnic to get his teaching qualification.
Well, this be like Dangerous Minds or something where he has to go and earn his stripes. I'll be honest, I know we skirt around it. It would be a lot better than the sequel to this film that they actually did make.
Have you actually seen that?
I've seen about 20 minutes of it and the trailer.
Wow.
The 20 minutes ended by choice. As people may know, I have a lot of love for Dolph Lundgren and his body of work. Mm. But yes, Kindergarten Cop 2, which does exist. People think I've photoshopped the poster. I have not. It looks like someone has. But yeah, it came out maybe 5 years ago, straight to DVD. Mm. And it is as bad as you'd think it would be.
I was tempted to watch it in preparation for this, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. So I am going to ask Rich Nelson, is Kindergarten Cop still any good?
Honestly, I think, whether it's a time thing or not, but since having kids, I found this film a lot funnier than I did previously. I was always quite fond of the film, but I think, circumstance has made it still good. It's still enjoyable. Whether that meets the criteria, I'm not sure, but I very much enjoyed watching it again. I didn't have too many hang-ups about it. I laughed more this time than I did last time.
I sort of agree. I still really, really enjoyed it. I think from the same sort of position as you, in that now I have watched it with children of my own, so I can kind of empathise with how awful they can be. One of the only issues I've got is, I think the film is too long. I think they could have cut out sort of 20 minutes of it. It's nearly a 2-hour long film, and he doesn't actually get to the school until like about minute 32, minute 33. So that first bit, although necessary, I think it does go on a little bit too long, and it's not what we came for. We came for him going to the school and getting into all sorts of crazy antics. And like I said before, the target audience thing is a bit weird with the violence at the beginning and the knockabout fun in the middle. But yeah, the school stuff is still really, really entertaining. Sometimes a little bit morally and politically tone deaf, but like we said, it was the early 90s. But I think I'd show my eldest daughter this one with no problem at all. She watched Jaws all the way through the other day, so I think she'll be fine with this.
There won't be any issues around just when you thought it was safe to go back to the kindergarten, but...
Yeah, so I thought it was good too. I thought it still stood up and it was good fun.
I think, as you say, I think it could do with a little bit of trimming, and I think they've oversold the plot element around Mr. Crisp a little bit too much. Yes, you have to engineer why he's in the school, but there was a bit too much at the beginning. That's maybe where they could have lost some of the time.
Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, it was really enjoyable. And I think looking back now, yes, there are parts of it that really aren't correct at all and need to be changed if they're ever going to do anything with it. But it tickled me in a way that it hadn't before. And it wasn't just the sort of, it's not a tumour.
There was certainly more to it than that. Yeah. So, OK, I think we are probably just about done. Is there anything that you'd like to plug? I'm sure there's one thing in particular you'd like to plug.
Yeah, well, if you like Schwarzenegger films or films that really haven't aged particularly well, then I do the Betamax Video Club podcast, which focuses on films that are 80s movies. There are films of all kind. They go from 9 to 5 to Predator to Steel Magnolias and back. Some of them have aged remarkably well, all things considered. Some of them really, really have not. Again, like this, we talk about films and how they've aged and would we watch them again, how have they stood up, and a lot of it is trying to be positive about the nostalgia of it, and a couple of them kind of slipped through the net in terms of, you know, a lot of people didn't realize that they'd made TV movies about the Ewoks, for example, so that was painful because I had to watch both of them.
One of the things I do especially like about it is it does come from that place of warmth and affection that the guests you have on, they've chosen a favorite film, you speak about everything about it without any kind of cynicism, which is what we do. We're probably a little bit more cynical and a little bit more critical, but yours is from that just real place of affection. Your people are genuine fans. They do their homework, they do their research, and it's a really good, really interesting, really in-depth talk. So I am a big fan of yours as well. So yes, listeners, tune in. It's Betamax Video Club. It's great.
Oh, cheers, Chris.
I think it's about time to wrap up, so we'll just do the usual housekeeping. If you want to get in touch with us, we are on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod, Instagram, StillAnyGoodPod. We're also on Facebook, StillAnyGood, and if you want to email us, we're at StillAnyGood@gmail.com. And please remember to rate and review us from wherever you get your podcast. Rich, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, Chris.
Really, really great having you on. I really enjoyed that.
No, it was great fun. Any excuse to rewatch this again? It's the most I've laughed in the house for a while.
Well, if we're able to provide that service, then that's great.
My work here is done.
Fantastic. Thanks very much. Okay, we'll see you all soon, folks. Cheerio. Bye-bye. So I'm going to have to stop. I've got cramp.
Nope. Ah, shit. Ow. Fuck it up. Oh, my Christ.
Perfect material for the outtakes.
Christ, sorry. I'm going to have to walk it off. Ah, fuck. Oh. It's back again. Shit.